We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Water is the most vital substance in our lives, yet all too often we take it for granted. Our guest for this hour, journalist Charles Fishman, says, in the developed world, we have spent the last 100 years in an aquatic paradise. But that, he says, is changing. In fact, here's the way that he writes about it in his new book that we'll be talking about. He writes, we are entering a new era of water scarcity, not just in traditionally dry or hard-pressed places like the U.S. Southwest and the Middle East, but also places we think of as water-wealthy, places like Atlanta and Melbourne. The three things that we've taken to be the natural state of our water supply, abundant, cheap, and safe, will not be present together in the decades ahead. At the same time, having spent a lot of time traveling around the globe and studying these issues, he is optimistic. At least he says that we have actually made some progress in being much smarter about the way that we use water, and there's a great potential to use technology for us to be even smarter still. The book that we're talking about, it's recently published. The title is The Big Thirst. The subtitle is The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. The Free Press is the publisher. Our guest, Charles Fishman, is author of another book, The Walmart Effect. That was a big bestseller. He's won some awards for his business journalism since 1996. He's worked for the business magazine Fast Company, and he's joining us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And also we have email. So if you'd like to send in a question that way, you can do that. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. So if at any point here you got questions, so you can give us a call. We just hope people can be brief and can be on target with the topic. Otherwise, your questions and comments are welcome. And Mr. Fishman, hello.
Good morning. Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. There's so much interesting stuff in this book, things that I'm sure that people don't know about water. I think probably people, you know, they know the things about, well, so much of the earth is water and so much of our bodies are water, that kind of stuff.
But in sixth grade, we're all populated with the little sixth grade factoids. 71% of the surface of the water and 60% of our bodies. We all remember those.
But there's a lot of other things that I'm sure people don't know, and I certainly didn't know. For example, and I'm sure this is the thing that people often start out talking about, that the water that we have now on the Earth, it didn't originate here. It came from someplace else, and it came here a long time ago, and what we've got is what we've got. That is all we have ever had, all we ever will have.
Yeah, I'm almost a little embarrassed. I've been a reporter for 30 years, and I was 3 or 4 months into reporting the book, working on water every day, and I sort of realized one afternoon, I don't even know what sparked the question. I had no idea where the water on Earth came from. Hmm. Sort of, I rocked back in my chair at my desk, and I thought, well, where did Lake Michigan come from? Where did Niagara Falls or the Pacific Ocean come from? And I started making, literally that moment, I started making phone calls, because if you're an adult, that seems like that's one of those why is the sky blue questions. What is gravity? Where did the water come from? It turns out that the water on Earth was manufactured in space, out in an interstellar gas cloud in the Milky Way somewhere. There's no mechanism on Earth for permanently creating or destroying water. All the water we've got was delivered here at about the time the planet was formed. There's a lot of dispute about how it got here. Water is, of course, taken apart in photosynthesis, and when we eat the plants, water's put back together, but the amount of water we've got on Earth is constant, and there's no geological mechanism for creating or destroying water. And I was sort of, that does two things. First of all, everything on Earth, of course, was delivered from space, right? Your iPhone, your Toyota Camry, your Levi's blue jeans, in some sense, all came from space. But water is the only thing that you encounter every day in routine use that was delivered from space that is in exactly the same form as when it was delivered here 4 billion years ago. Your Toyota Camry is made of stuff that came from space, but Toyota Camrys don't land on Earth from the Milky Way. And the second thing it reminds you of is it's all recycled wastewater. All the water we've got is all the water we've ever had. And so water is infinitely reusable because, you know, in some sense, your bottle of Evian is dinosaur pee. And also, there's no mechanism for creating new water, so we actually do have to husband the resource that we have. We have more than enough of it, but there's no way of, in real terms, there's no way of making new water, and there's no mechanism for making new water. So we've got to take care of the water we've got, right? Those two things were really remarkable to discover.
So it's really interesting that if you think about, for example, if you make these parallels to the conversation that we're having now about energy, and we're talking about things like oil. Well, we're always reminded that oil is not renewable. It's finite, and that we can use up what there is. And so now there are a lot of questions about, well, how much is there, and how much longer will it take us to use up what there is? Now, there certainly are issues with water. There are not a lot of issues about water, but that issue, that is using it up, that doesn't apply.
No, and in fact, it doesn't apply so much that I think one of the things that's going to change about our attitude about water and our relationship to water is that I think in the next 10 and 20 years, we're going to get a lot more comfortable with reusing wastewater much more quickly. I mean, all the water we use is recycled wastewater, as we just said, at some level, right? The question is, when was it, when did somebody or something drink it, how long ago? But water can be cleaned very easily and in many cases relatively inexpensively. There are lots of communities around the world that have started basic reuse programs where they take the wastewater that they already collect, right, in the system after somebody uses it, they clean it pretty clean and use it for irrigation purposes. One of the places that does that is Central Florida, Orange County, Florida, which is home to Orlando, which most people are familiar with. They actually have been recycling their wastewater in a fairly sophisticated way for 25 years just for outdoor landscape watering, for irrigation for your home, but also for soccer fields, office parks. They now supply as much recycled wastewater, what's called purple pipe water, because it's actually delivered in purple pipes. The amount of potable water they supply every day equals the amount of recycled wastewater they supply. So they have doubled the size of Orange County, Florida in 25 years without taking a single extra drop of potable water, and they water their lawns and their soccer fields with recycled wastewater, not purified drinking water. And so they're saving water, and they're also changing the attitude. In Central Florida, people think it's a little silly to take water that's clean enough to drink and water your azaleas with it.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, gets at a really fundamental point, and that is that we take potable water, the same stuff that comes out of our tap that we can drink, and we use that for all sorts of uses where you actually don't need to have water that's that clean, like watering your plants, like washing your clothes. Well, I'm not sure about washing your clothes, but
flushing the toilet.
Certainly, that would be one where you don't need to have drinking quality water to flush the toilet, and yet we're doing that.
Right, and that I think if we take one step back, it's okay to say, wow, what's amazing is the engineering system that was created in most communities 100 years ago, you know, more recently in places like Orlando and Las Vegas and Phoenix, that they created a system that supplied not just water, but really clean water. And we've grown accustomed to using the highest grade of water available for every purpose. And the system is so successful. We never think about it. It never fails. We don't go through the day. We can go through most of our lives without ever having to think about our water supply as ordinary Americans. And that's extraordinary. It's worth appreciating. But in fact, that very invisibility, that very sort of thoughtlessness undermines the system itself. We don't think that system needs any resources or any modernization. And in fact, the drinking water system in many communities is kind of decrepit. And also, we need to rethink it in just the way you were saying. As I say kind of in the book, we need to use the right quality of water for the right purpose to the degree that we can, you know, in sort of economic terms. We're not going to replumb every home in Illinois so that the toilets use recycled wastewater. That's not a good use of resources. But every time there's a new subdivision anywhere in the U.S., that subdivision should think completely differently about water, and the potable water should be used for things that you need potable water for, and there's nothing wrong with using recycled wastewater for things like flushing the toilet and watering the lawn, and there are places that are thinking that way, and I sort of tried to tell those stories so that people would say, oh, you're right. Flushing the toilet with drinking water is kind of silly.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Charles Fishman. He's a business writer. He works for the business magazine Fast Company and is author of this new book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water, published by the Free Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think it's really interesting that you got into this subject by writing about bottled water, which is a great story in and of itself. And what's really remarkable here is that we have people who live in places, and here where we live is one of them, where you can go into your kitchen and open the tap and pour yourself a glass of very good, high-quality water that's incredibly cheap. And yet at the same time, people are going out buying water, sometimes from a long way away, in a plastic bottle, and they're paying a whole lot more than they are for that glass of water that they could draw out their kitchen tap.
Yeah. the one of the top grocery sale items in America today, number two or number three in many grocery stores, is that 24-pack of half-liter bottles, sort of shrink-wrapped into a brick. Mm. It's too big to be a brick. That people take home. There's bananas, and then almost everybody rolling out of the grocery store has bananas and the 24-pack of half liters. And yet, I mean, I don't know how old you are. I grew up in the 60s and 70s. That product didn't even exist in 1970 or 1975. It really didn't even exist in 1980. We have kind of taught ourselves or been taught to drink bottled water. And yes, there are plenty of people who think that they need water from France, Evian, or water from Italy, San Pellegrino, or water from Fiji, Fiji water. And I guess I got started writing about water literally by writing about the business of bottled water. And I went to Fiji, and I went to San Pellegrino. And in Fiji, of course, the business of bottled water actually makes a huge difference in the lives of the people who work in the Fiji water plant. They are among the best paid people in the whole country. But it strikes me as completely, you know, insane in some ways that you can get clean, safe drinking water from Fiji in any convenience store in America when that virtually that same product, except for the aura, except for the sort of the mystery around it, the marketing, is available at home for free, in your tap. Mm. So it's not my job to tell anybody what they should drink. People like, you know, wine from Australia, and they like coffee from Guatemala, and they like exotic chocolate from Europe. But I think you should understand what the impact is. And I also think we need to be careful because bottled water is very slowly undermining confidence in the tap water system and support for the tap water system. And that's dangerous. Tap water almost universally in the U.S., is cleaner and much more closely monitored than bottled water. So it's as safe or safer, and it's typically as good. And you can't run your economy on bottled water. You need a good municipal water system to have a good, vibrant economy. And I think it's easy to lose track of that.
You know, it really, but I just have to say, it really blew my mind the day that I realized that Fiji water wasn't just a name, that it actually came from Fiji. That bottle of water actually came from Fiji.
It is incredible, David. It's so incredible that that's the only reason I've spent the last 4 years of my life paying attention to water. That's, in fact, the story. We were visiting my parents. My family was visiting my parents where I grew up in Miami. And the hotel room we were in 5 years ago had Fiji water in the rooms for your pleasure. And my wife cracked open a bottle of it and drank it and said, "My, this actually tastes great." And I said, "Do you think that water actually came to Miami from Fiji?" And then I went back home and I was sort of looking. I actually saved the Fiji water bottle and took it back with us from Florida to Philadelphia. And it turns out that 53% of the people in Fiji don't have access to clean, safe drinking water. And so the global economy that we all talk about and admire has contrived to provide clean, safe drinking water to Americans at their absolute demand in any convenience store or grocery store in America. And yet the place where that water comes from, those people, the global economy hasn't managed to get them clean, safe drinking water from their own communities. And so once I had that contrast in my mind, I thought, well, this is really a story, to ask the question exactly as you did. How come we've got water from Fiji here, and what does that mean?
Well, and then the other part of this, too, is that it just shows you that we're maybe kind of confused in how we think about water, so we're willing to pay a premium for water that comes all the way from Fiji in a plastic bottle, when the water that we have at home, not only is it good, but it's very cheap, it's very inexpensive, and we adding on to that, as you note in the book, that even though what we pay, generally what people pay in this country for water service at their home is quite inexpensive, anytime someone talks about raising the rates, people just start to holler.
Yeah, they do. It is interesting. If you buy a half liter of bottle from the a half liter bottle of water from the cold case in a convenience store in a 7-Eleven or wherever, it costs about 99 cents. The Fiji water or the Evian might cost $1.49 for the half liter. Water service at home is $1 a day for 400 gallons. So you could refill the bottle that you buy in the cold case every day for 8 years before you would use 99 cents of tap water. So it's literally thousands of times more expensive to buy it in the convenience store, to buy it in the bottle already packaged for you, than to drink it from the tap. People are buying the occasion. They're buying convenience. And I can understand that. But I do think it undermines people's confidence and support for the tap water system. You know, you talk about people's resistance to raising the water bill. We really have this kind of gut instinct that water should be free somehow. And so the average water bill in an American home is literally $34 a month, $1 a day. And that's half what the cell phone bill is, half what the cable TV bill is. 10 or 15 years ago, we didn't even have a cell phone bill or a cable TV bill. And yet, if you try and raise if you say to people, boy, the water system hasn't been modernized in 70 years, we're going to add $4 to your bill a month, 10 cents a day, people act like they're going to have to choose between their water service and food. And so I think the first thing that people really need to do is pause for a moment and appreciate what that water service means, what it provides, and how incredibly inexpensive it is compared to all kinds of other things, including water itself at the grocery store.
Yeah, and that issue of not having the money to invest in infrastructure improvement for the system is a significant, is a very significant issue in a number of respects. And one obvious one is one of the things that we know is, you know, the, many of the systems we have are old and they actually leak. We're actually wasting water. We're losing water because it's leaking out of the system because the system is old, needs repairs. But the because the water is cheap, the people who oversee those systems, it's very difficult for them to get the money to make the improvements.
That is exactly right. We're leaking. We leak about 15% of the water that cities, that municipalities provide every day. We leak 1 gallon in six. Whatever business you're in, imagine losing 1/6 of your production after you acquired it, you know, and got it ready for your customers and sent it out to them and then just threw it in the garbage. So we, you know, we pay to find the source of water, whether it's a reservoir or an aquifer or a river, pump it, store it, clean it, send it out into the pipes with the electricity and the pumps and the people necessary to do that. And then before it reaches a business or a home, 1 out of 6 gallons leaks away. Now, unfortunately, the bad news is it isn't as if in Chicago or New York or Orlando or Champaign-Urbana there's 4 big leaks, and if you could just fix them, you'd fix the problem. The systems leak all over the place, and so you have to work on them steadily and improve them. The good news is there's all kinds of new technology to help find where water is escaping and fix it, but that kind of modernization does take some resources, and the first thing people say is, where's the money going to come from? And so we spend – this is the thing that's sort of hard to get your brain around. In the U.S., we spend $21 billion a year on bottled water. That's $70 per person, man, woman, and child, on bottled water. And we spend $29 billion a year maintaining and modernizing the entire water system. We spend almost as much on water delivered in crushable plastic bottles as we do on this sort of fundamental infrastructure system. So there is water. There is water. There is money available to help the water system. And we're already spending it on water, in fact. We just need to be able to sort of get our brains around the idea that it's okay to spend money on something that's so important. And the fact that we haven't had to think about it for 30 years doesn't mean it doesn't need some attention.
All right. We have several callers here. We'll get to them and hope people can help us by being brief. That way we'll get as many in as we can. And we'll start in with Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Thank you, David. Just a comment and 2 questions. I'm a gardener, and I have gutters and 2 40-gallon rain barrels. And so I don't use the hose. But in any case, could you address the process of evaporation and rain, which I think is the system? I could be wrong on that. And then the talk, which I deem is kind of mythic, is desalinization. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Well, can you say something about those 2 things?
I'm not quite sure what the question about evaporation is, but I'm glad he uses rain barrels. That's brilliant, and it's a, you know, it's a reminder that I think Champaign-Urbana gets between 3 and 4 feet of rain a year. So if you're a gardener, there's nothing wrong with collecting your own rainwater. That's a real resource. It's not an inconvenience. And in many communities, stormwater, we call it stormwater. That allows us to regarded as a waste product rather than rainwater. So I think that's actually really, really smart. And I'm not sure what he meant about sort of the, I think he used the word mythology about desalinization. You know, in the center of the country, desalination doesn't make much sense in economic terms. There are plenty of places where turning ocean water into drinking water is a standard practice and vital to the to supplying drinking water. One of the places I visited to write the book was Australia, which looks much like the United States, and which has had a terrible 10 years of of climate change, and every major city but one in Australia almost ran out of water, had a major water crisis. And five of those major cities, Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, Brisbane, are building desalination plants or have built them. Very expensive, very energy intensive, but in the view of people who live in coastal communities or near the ocean, that's a kind of climate-independent source of water. You can take ocean water, take the salt out, and drink that water. The process is not, there's nothing exotic about the process. Ships have been doing this for decades. It's not cheap, and it does require enormous quantities of energy, and so it's not clear that it's a brilliant solution in general, but there's lots of water in the ocean, and as long as you manage the super salinated water that results, you're taking the clean water out, so you end up with double concentrated salt water. As long as you're careful about how you put that back in the ocean and you don't damage the ecosystem, it's not a bad way of getting fresh water. It's just not an inexpensive way.
Okay. To Philo next, line 3. Hello.
Hi. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Go ahead.
I understand what you're saying. I agree with you primarily, but I have one criticism. When I'm standing in convenience stores looking for something to drink, that bottled water looks very tempting because it doesn't have any. It isn't a soda. It doesn't have any sugar in it. And for somebody whose doctor is telling them to reduce their sugar intake, that's a pretty important factor.
Absolutely, and I think a lot of the occasion on which people choose a cold bottle of water, especially if they're choosing it, you know, if they're a 14-year-old kid choosing it instead of a sugar drink, that's great. There's nothing, you know, as I said, it's not my job to tell you what to drink. And I don't think bottled water is the water problem, except insofar as it represents people doing something thoughtlessly rather than thoughtfully. But the 24 packs that are going home from the grocery store, in some ways those are different. You know, we, in our family, we used to send our kids to school, two kids every day, with a bottle of water, a plastic bottle of water. And that's really not that smart, and it's not necessary. We send them with a reusable water bottle now. We keep the water bottles come home, they get emptied, they get cleaned, we fill them, put them in the fridge, and as they walk out the door with their lunches, they get the reusable water bottle. So I'm not telling people not to drink bottled water, and you're right. There are plenty of occasions where it's absolutely the most appealing thing. But, you know, we used to rely on water fountains, and they work great too. So I think you just need to make sure you're understanding what you're doing when you do it.
Well, yeah, and like I say, I mean, I understand the leakage problem of, you know, in our towns and cities is terrible. I mean, you know, you're leaking so much water into the ground, and it's just gone.
Well, and that's a great source of water, right?
If yeah,
you, as,
sure
if you can, if somebody walked up to most cities in America and said, "I've got a magic way of increasing your water supply 15%," most water managers would say, "Great, sit down, let's talk. What do we need to do?"
Yeah.
Well, that recovering the water that you're letting leak out is that mad? You know, that's one quick way of getting back your water, but you do have to spend money to do it, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We're talking this morning in this part of Focus with Charles Fishman. We're talking about water, the subject of his book, The Big Thirst, and we will talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
How are public schools funded in the United States? How should they be funded? School funding is the topic this week on Examining Education. We'll hear from Ralph Martiri on public funding of education, Henry Levin on privatization of schools, and U of I Professor Emeritus Walter McMahon on the economics of education. Join Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley for Examining Education, Saturdays at 6 this month on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you here with us. We are here during the week, and we have 10 different topics for you. In the second hour today, another trip to the Deep Archives. This is a project that we're doing to mark our 30th anniversary. The show's been on the air 30 years, and we are digging into the archives, programs we have that are recorded, actually recorded on cassette. They're stored in boxes in our tape library, and they have not been heard in a long time. And so today you'll hear a 1994 interview with anthropologist Mary Catherine Bateson, and then from 1999, historian Theodore Rozak. Next week on Monday, Gretchen Morgenson is the guest. She's a reporter for the New York Times. We'll talk about the economic meltdown, the crisis in the mortgage market, what's happened with banking here in this country the last few years, the subject of her book, Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption led to economic Armageddon. Then also Monday, we'll be taking your health care questions. This is a show that we do every other month with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl. And any and all questions about health are welcome. You can check up on the schedule, find out what we'll be doing. You can listen to past programs by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. The guest in this hour of Focus is Charles Fishman. He is the author of the book, The Walmart Effect. He is a journalist. He works for the business magazine Fast Company. And he's also author of a new book just recently out that is titled The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Free Press is the publisher in the book. And he makes this argument in the book that the golden age of water, one where water is unlimited, safe, and free, is over. He also is optimistic in the sense that he thinks that we're doing better in the way that we use water. We're getting smarter, and we can do better still. So you can find out more about that in the book, and questions and comments are welcome. 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 are the numbers. You want to give us a call. We're back to the phones here, and our next caller is in Champaign, and line number one right here. Hello.
Good morning. Thank you very much for raising this vital issue. I lived in South Africa for quite a long time, and because of apartheid, millions of people didn't have access, to clean water. And since that time, the debate around water provision, a lot of it has focused around the issue of privatization, and a number of transnational companies have tried to make inroads into the water provision there and find a way to make quite considerable profit off of it. And one of the things is that, as you said, here Americans maybe take water for granted, but literally in South Africa, people in communities were being forced to prepay their water, and at cost which became actually quite significant amounts of their family budget. And so they were actually having to make the choice that you've noted between food and water. And so I'm just wondering, what you think about the question of privatization versus state provision of water services, particularly in countries where, as you noted in Fiji, but also in the Pacific, where the people that are working in the water factories don't have access to water. So I'm wondering what you see the role of private companies versus state provision in this issue.
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I actually spent almost a month in India, which is a place with the same kind of problems as, on a grand scale as South Africa in terms of water accessibility. There's plenty of water in India, and yet in a country of 1.2 billion people, half the people, 600 million people, don't have access to clean water every day. I don't diminish the problems of privatization. I don't think you want to turn control of something as fundamental over to private companies. At the same time, the fact that half the people in India don't have water couldn't be a more startling indictment of those local governments and regional governments. What is a more fundamental role than providing water to your citizens? You know, education and water. I would say those are the basics. And so I'm actually one of these people who thinks that companies have a role in providing water if there is strong oversight and if they are well managed and if fundamental control, basic control of both the resource and pricing remain with the governmental entity. When I was in India, one of the things I really wanted to do was the water walk. There's literally a billion people in the world every day who rely on water carried by foot. And you never read about what it's like to carry water by foot. And so I did that water walk with the women and girls of a village in India, the village of Jargali. And, you know, many, many women and girls, their whole day is taken up going and fetching water enough for their families. And then the day is over, and the next day that's what they do. They go fetch water. The entire time I was on the water walk in India, we had cell phone service. And the women who were on the walk, most of them had basic cell phones. And so you could, while you were walking to get the water from the well out in the middle of the field, in the middle of nowhere, you could call the environment minister for the state that this village was in and have a conversation about why you couldn't have water service, but you could have cell phone service. So I think there's a balance between allowing governments to provide a service which they're often failing to provide and simply turning the whole thing over to private profit-making corporations who then exploit, you know, the desperate need for water. And I think the balance is that sometimes companies can move quickly, can bring technology and resources to bear that governments can't, as long as you don't leave them in control. And the places where privatization has failed, it has most often failed because the same government that wasn't competent to provide the water service in the first place turned out not to be competent to manage the company it had turned the water system over to.
Yeah. And just to underscore that point, that the story that you tell, I think it gives you the opportunity to make the point that there are many places in the world where people every day, every week, invest an enormous amount of time and energy in one activity, and that is getting water, going to whatever the source is, where the water is, and then bringing it back to where they need it to be. And, you know, you have to think about the fact that if you're spending hours and hours and hours every day just walking back and forth with water, what are you not doing?
Well, it's absolutely economically crippling. I mean, it's so hard to understand. That's why I went and did the water walk, because I really wanted to absorb what it meant every day. I mean, we in the United States, we don't ever have to think about our water service, you know, almost without question. And that's actually very unusual in the history of humanity. If you go back even 100 years, people even in the developed world had to think about their water most days. Where was it coming from? You know, even if it meant you just had to walk out to the well in the backyard and get it. But literally almost half the world, 40% of the people in the world, have to think about their water all the time, every hour of every day. In the developing world, this literally prevents grown women from having real jobs or from helping produce farm, you know, increase the productivity of the farmland. They're walking to get water. It prevents girls from going to school. They don't get an education because they spend their days walking to get water. And so I use the phrase in the book, which sounds extreme, but I don't think is, which is it's a kind of water slavery. You're not just enslaved to the water. It's a kind of slavery of your economic future. It limits all of your economic possibilities because you're spending all your time walking to carry water. And I just think, I think the countries where that's happening, almost all of them, in fact, can muster the resources to change that situation and should. But also, just as human beings, that is something we should not, you know, we should not permit. If there's a basic, I like to use this comparison, which is stark, it may not be all that useful. For the money we have spent fighting the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we could literally have provided water systems for every community in the world. And so it's not a question of available resources. It's a question of focus and priorities.
We have some other callers. Next is Georgetown. This is line 4.
Yes, very interesting topic. I think it's very worthwhile. I belong to a couple of organizations, and we collect our change at each meeting, and then that is pooled because this organization is nationwide, and it's pooled together. So there's a large sum. I mean, people in every state are contributing to this, and it's sent over to Africa for the purpose of drilling wells so people over there can have access to free, clean, fresh water. So, you know, we feel like we're doing our part to help those people in the country who, like you talked about, a lot of their day is spent in trying to get fresh water. Unfortunately, we in the U.S. just take that for granted that we have fresh, clean water, and I think we are very, very wasteful and maybe sorry someday. I never ever thought that I would pay to buy a bottle of water like is so common anymore. I understand the convenience of it, and it is nice, you know, when you go someplace to have the choice of pop or a bottle of water or something like that, and I understand that. But I think many of the organizations have forgotten that we do have 2, 3, 4, 5 gallon jugs that are insulated, probably in everybody's basement, that could simply be filled with water and taken to the Cub Scout meeting or the baseball game or whatever, and have some cups there, and they wouldn't be having all the pollution, because I'm sure a lot of those bottles of water, empty bottles, don't get recycled. And we supposedly have clean, safe water. I think some of our communities have not been as vigilant as possible, and they have found some breaches as far as something was wrong with the water, and maybe that's kind of forced or made people think, well, I need to buy it, and yet when you buy it, you're not sure where that water actually came from. It probably just came out of the tap down the street, for all we know. And it might not, you know, might not be any safer than what's right out of your faucet. But you brought up a lot of good points, and it's been very interesting this morning. And I think we do need to look at this as far as spending so much money on providing clean water to our cities and everything, and then we're spending the same amount to bottle the water. I agree. It doesn't hardly make sense.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I guess, it makes me think about it. And one of the things you write about in the book is the fact that, you know, one of the biggest issues in international development is trying to provide people with a ready source of clean water. And despite the fact that people have been working on this and doing this, a lot of non-governmental organizations have been doing this for a long time, still a significant number of people around the world don't have access to clean water.
Well, yeah, it's one of those things where there, you know, every week, every other week, a new water charity is created, a new celebrity decides water is an important focus. To me, the good news about water is sort of two things. First, ordinary people who have water also have a good relationship with water, right? We actually like water. We have affection for it. We appreciate, you know, a hot shower. We appreciate a swimming pool in the middle of the summer. And I think that emotional connection is actually very valuable. And the other thing is that even in the developing world, and certainly in communities like the United States, across the United States, water problems are typically solvable. That's one of the things that I was most struck by in reporting the book and in traveling from place to place around the world. You know, if we're going to wean ourselves from fossil fuels, we have to reinvent our entire economy, the way it functions every minute of every day. We need new technology. We need breakthroughs. We need a different source of cheap energy. We need to retrofit every car and train and so forth. Water problems don't require any technological breakthroughs. We have all kinds of interesting technology. Most problems are solvable. And many communities that sort of struggle with water, even in the developing world, have water resources. They just haven't tapped them. And so for most places, the key is not the water itself or even the technology. It's the people. It's somebody coming in and saying, you know, here's a way of getting water to your people that's simple, that's sort of appropriate to the technology level of this community. Let's do this together. And I think the most effective water charities, the most effective water NGOs, are those that go into places and help the people in those communities get their own water rather than bring water to them.
Yeah.
It is one of those things you need to be engaged in the process of providing so that you can sustain it. You know, water for a month with fancy piece of technology doesn't do you any good. People need to be able to have access to water permanently.
About 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus. Charles Fishman is our guest. He's the author of the recent book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to ask what he thought of the situation with the natural gas companies fracking for oil, causing disruptions and breached wells, affecting the water tables and systems.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. For those in the audience who don't know, just briefly, there are all kinds of new natural gas discoveries across the U.S., and the technology for getting the natural gas out of the ground, it's thousands of feet down, is to inject water into the rock, and the water itself goes down with all kinds of chemicals in it to make it more potent at breaking open the rock. And then the natural gas is released from the rock and comes back up to the surface along with the water that was used to break the rock. And this process requires millions of gallons of water. The water is mixed with, polluted with chemicals on the way down and comes back up with all kinds of hydrocarbons in it. And there's no question we need the natural gas. There's also no question we need clean water. And so my answer to your question is I think we should go after the natural gas, but only while also protecting the water supply in the communities where the natural gas exists. The gas companies have a tendency to say, we won't pollute the water, and please don't make us not pollute it, because then the gas won't be economically affordable. Well, if it's not affordable to get the gas and keep the water clean before you get it, it's not going to be affordable to get the gas and clean up the mess afterward. And so the truth is, in most cases previous like this, now is the time to impose rules that allow you to both get at the natural resource and absolutely protect the water. Because after the gas has been extracted, no one's going to be interested in cleaning up the mess.
Just we're coming down to, we have a couple of minutes left, and there's one other thing that I want to make sure we at least talk a little bit about. In the beginning, we talk about all of the things that people don't know about water, like where it comes from. But I think something else that people really don't appreciate is who are the big water users in the United States. And it is a fact that industrial uses are huge, and I'm not even talking here about agriculture. I'm not talking about irrigation. We're talking about other industrial uses, like the electricity generating industry, for example, uses enormous amounts of water. So there is something that needs to be accounted for. One needs to acknowledge that those are big users. But also, I think that one of the points you make in the book is that actually many industrial users have made some progress in the direction of greater efficiency in the way that they use the water.
Absolutely. Electricity generation accounts for 49% of the water used every day in the U.S., half the water. A single nuclear power plant, just one, uses the same amount of water every day as a city of 5 million people. That's cooling water, but it's still real water. And factories of all kinds use water, and most of their water is free. I mean, one of the themes that runs through the book that we haven't touched on at all is the fact that water is free for people means that we don't place much value on using it smartly or using it efficiently. That's particularly true at the, you know, in the large volume users in terms of companies and farmers. And so one of the things I advocate is I think water should be a little more expensive. The money you collect should be reinvested back in a system that desperately needs it and in sustaining the water system. And in fact, most big users of water, if their water were a little more expensive, the first thing they would do is use less of it. They'd find ways of using it more smartly, which would also help take pressure off the system. You've alluded to this, but we should be really clear. In the last 30 years, between 1980 and 2011, the U.S. has actually reduced the total amount of water it uses as a country. We've grown by 70 million people, we've doubled the size of the economy, and we actually use less water. And that savings doesn't come very much from us taking shorter showers. It comes from the big users being more efficient and realizing the value of water and of paying attention to scarcity. And so if the U.S. can double the size of its economy while reducing the amount of water it uses, to me that's actually a very hopeful note, a good note to end on, in fact, because it means any community can do much better than they're doing now.
Well, one other thing, we had talked earlier about the fact that there is no reason why one cannot take the water that people flush down their toilets and clean it and filter it and give it back to people for them to drink again. Now, people are going to immediately get ill probably when they hear that, but there are, in fact, places that they do it. Now, it may not be quite so direct, so that there's a little bit of remove, and that makes people feel easier about it. But you know, how do you get people used to that idea?
Well, I think this is all a question of education. You know, if you eat in a restaurant for dinner, you're putting in your mouth the very same silverware that somebody at breakfast or lunch put in their mouth. That doesn't repulse you. You don't think that's gross. You think, hey, the silverware went through the dishwasher. It's clean. We know how the silverware gets cleaned. The same is true of the sheets and towels in a hotel room. They were used by somebody else yesterday or the day before. We're not uncomfortable using them again. But we know how the laundry works. We know how the dishwasher works. I think we separate wastewater and drinking water for good reason. Wastewater can cause disease. But I think the more we know about the technology available to clean water, which is truly extraordinary, the more comfortable we'll be with the idea that the distance in time between the time water was used before and the time it's being used again isn't nearly as important as what got done to the water. Just like we don't think, oh, the silverware better sit in the drawer for 2 days before I'm willing to use it. We know it went through scalding water. It's fine. It's not gonna hurt us. It is clean. And water can be the same way. The problem is we don't have any familiarity with the technology that's used to clean water in that way. And I think, you know, part of the value of the book and part of the value of having a conversation is to be able to say to people, you wouldn't believe how clean you can make water, and so it's okay. There's nothing – once water's been cleaned to drinking water standards, you don't actually have to worry about it.
There, we'll have to leave it. The book is The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water by our guest Charles Fishman. He works for the business magazine Fast Company. His earlier book is The Walmart Effect, and in fact, we talked about that in January of 2006, and that interview is on our web archive. So if you want to hear it, you can go to will.illinois.edu. Mr. Fishman, thanks very much.
Thanks. You don't have to wait 30 years. Thank you all very much.